Today is the 29th of June 2011, and I am James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and today I'm talking to Andrew Gavin Marshall, a research associate of the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca. Andrew Marshall, it is a pleasure to have you back on the program today. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Andrew, today I wanted to talk about some of the research that I know that you've done, as you've done some extensive research on the ways that the robber barons of the 19th century set up the tax-free foundations through which they were able to direct and use their wealth and direct it towards shaping society in the name of philanthropy. So perhaps you could talk about who are some of the people who set up these foundations, where did their money come from, and how and why did they choose to use their wealth in this manner?
Sure. Well, these were the industrialists and bankers known as the robber barons in the 19th century. So you had J.P. Morgan, Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, these types of names would come up, and these were the major industrialists that made their vast fortunes amounting to even the billions in the early 1900s. Which really says where the family wealth is today. But essentially, the 19th century was a century of enormous class struggle in the United States. You had massive labor unrest throughout the entire 19th century, and these robber barons very overtly pillaged the country and exploited labor and crushed unions and oppressed any sort of resistance. So you had a very radicalized labor movement, which was at times very Marxist, very anarchist, very socialist. And then you had these major industrialists who were very unapologetic about exploiting the labor and buying politicians and politics, specifically following the Civil War. Now, at the same time, you had these robber barons were also challenging an older elite, the sort of landed aristocracy. So they set up the major universities to challenge the old universities, which were designed to produce sort of gentlemen, religious studies, these types of aspects. So they established universities. John D. Rockefeller founded University of Chicago. Vanderbilt University, of course, is named after the Vanderbilts, also robber barons. Cornell, Brown, these types of schools emerged to implement social sciences, to create a new elite capable of managing their type of society. Now, in the early 20th century, they decided to create these philanthropic foundations. Now, Andrew Carnegie was the first one to do this in 1911 with the Carnegie Corporation. John D. Rockefeller founded the Rockefeller Foundation in 1913. And later on, of course, you had the Ford Foundation. But these foundations were essentially created as engines of social engineering. And their main focus initially, the Rockefeller Foundation was created in the midst of a huge scandal for the Rockefellers. There was a mining strike in Colorado, and the Rockefellers paid the National Guard to go in and crush it, and this was referred to as the Ludlow Massacre, in which several women and even children were killed. This created a huge, essentially public relations fiasco for the Rockefellers. So the Rockefeller Foundation emerged at this time to sort of counteract that on the part of the foundation, while the company, the Rockefeller Standard Oil mining interests, they countered it with the emergence of public relations. The Rockefeller Foundation itself countered it with the construction of ideology. Now, this is where the foundations really come into play. Their purpose is essentially to create consent to the hegemony of the ruling class, whether it's an empire like America or whether it's an oligarchy, like the Rockefellers, Morgans, etc., or both. The aim is to create consent to the hegemonic powers. In one way that hegemony is ordered is through coercion. This is the obvious mechanism of the state, police, military, etc. However, consent is a little more insidious and creates a more lasting power structure. In this sense, these foundations were created to engineer ideology, both on the part of elites and on the part of academics and the rest of society, but they also steer social movements. So a lot of what they've been doing since their beginning is to control social movements and to steer them in directions that are safe for elites. The foundations initially were very much involved in eugenics and promoting this as an elite ideology. They further strengthened and organized elite ideology through the creation of think tanks. The Rockefeller Foundation and Carnegie Corporation were central in the creation of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Foreign Policy Association, the Brookings Institution, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, the Bilderberg Group, and the Trilateral Commission, just to name a few of the big ones. These think tanks bring together elites from all realms of society, organize them to create a consensus among elites in terms of policy issues. They also form the sort of globalist or international ideas that have sprouted out from these types of think tanks. Further, the foundations, Rockefeller Foundation and Carnegie Corporation, in the 1920s, in 1924, they established the Social Science Research Council. This is a sort of a fund organization through which they would pass money to various universities, creating and essentially molding the disciplines of political science, economics, sociology, and many other fields of study. In this sense, they shaped the academic discipline itself. And so the people who study political science, people who study economics, the people who study sociology, they go through programs that are largely engineered by these major foundations in order to produce people who are able to properly manage the society that these foundations are pivotal in engineering. And in the 1950s, the Ford Foundation really came into the forefront in engineering this type of program as well. And they shaped, the Rockefeller Foundation essentially shaped the whole study of international relations. In the 50s onwards, new areas, as the America became the empire, area centers, area studies appeared in universities. And this was the idea that you train professionals to study Africa, to study Latin America, to study Asia. And the Ford Foundation really funded these institutes at universities to produce elites capable of managing and understanding the empire. And thus you had, in 1967, there was a study done in which there was 191 university institutes of area studies. And it was found that 109 of these institutes were dependent upon Ford Foundation funding. And so you have the whole realm of academic social sciences were essentially engineered by these foundations. And the aim is to promote reform of the system in order to create consent to the powers that control the system. So social science was seen as a method of social control, as a method of social engineering. And it's the idea of the professionalization of political science, of sociology, so that academics come to see themselves not as leaders of progressive or radical change movements, but as professionals, as experts in their field, as promoting certain reforms to the system, but ultimately as a part of the system. In specifically political science, they are in service to power, not challenging power. And that's sort of what the shaping of the social sciences has resulted in for these major foundations.
But defendants of these foundations might argue that the foundations themselves publish all of their activities. They are quite open about where their funds are going. There's nothing secretive or about that. It's quite a transparent process. So how could this be used in any sort of nefarious way if it's all out in the open and available to public scrutiny?
Well, the main issue there is that nobody scrutinizes it. It's not discussed in the academic world. And I study political science, I study these issues in school, or these subjects in school, and foundations simply are not in any curriculum. They shape the curriculum, but they're not studied in it. And that is the real problem here. The media will not discuss the foundations. And the alternative media often doesn't discuss the foundations because the foundations often fund the alternative media. There's very little criticism about these major foundations precisely because their purpose is to channel criticism into safe areas. McGeorge Bundy was the president of the Rockefeller Foundation for a great number of years in the 60s. He had this excellent quote where he said, "Everything the Ford Foundation does is to make the world safe for capitalism." Now, that's the essential aim of these foundations. If you wonder why there's no reasonable criticism, or at least there's not a lot of criticism about these organizations, it's because their purpose is to prevent criticism of the system. It's to take critics who they deem reasonable or fundable and have steer social movements, steer critical movements, movements opting for social change, opting for sort of social justice, these types of things, and they steer them in safe directions. One incredible example of this was actually with the civil rights movement. Now, at the time of the civil rights movement, you need not look further than Martin Luther King, his speech Beyond Vietnam in 1967, to see that the civil rights movement was generally, this is not exclusively, but generally anti-capitalist, anti-empire, obviously anti-racism. These were radical organizations, radical individuals leading them. The idea of black power came up. It was very threatening to the established powers that be. And of course, the foundations are run by these established powers. You go to the board of any major foundation, whether historically or presently, you see the top foreign policy strategists, bankers, corporate executives, leaders of universities. These people are well connected. They're not just philanthropists there for benevolent means. They're there to create consent to the system which they effectively run. Now, with the civil rights movement, what they did was they turned black power into black capitalism. So by funding all these organizations, because they have huge financial resources, so by funding civil rights groups, civil rights organizations, they can effectively channel money into specific areas. For example, the Ford Foundation created the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Now, this was to help pursue civil rights through legal means. So using the system, legalistic measures, they felt that it was a more of a reform-oriented organization. The NAACP, actually, its origins are with Rockefeller money. So by the Rockefeller Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Carnegie Corporation essentially steered money into these more legalistic entities, like the NAACP, promoting these organizations over more radical organizations promoting systemic change or revolutionary change. Therefore, the causes with a lot of money got a lot more input, got a lot more, had a much greater effect on the change that took place, and it became a very legalistic change. So essentially what you do is you change the faces, but not the system. So if you look, if you review Martin Luther King's speech Beyond Vietnam, everything he talked about in there is still relevant today. All that's changed is that now you can have a black president doing all the same things. So the same system was actually pursued in apartheid South Africa, where the foundations were also pivotal in not only creating the apartheid system, such as the Rockefeller Foundation helped in that establishment, but in changing it. So that in the 70s, in 1978 actually, the major foundations held study groups in the United States on changing policy in South Africa. And they saw the radical ANC, very socialist, reformist, radical, almost revolutionary, well, it was revolutionary, agenda that they had. And so they saw this change coming, and South Africa is simply too important for imperial interests. It always has been, it always will be. So it's unacceptable to have a revolutionary movement liberation struggle come up. So what they did was that they supported, again, the more legally oriented measures. They created NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and the foundations and the NGOs even ended up writing the Constitution. And all the radical revolutionary changes that were in the original documents of the ANC were gone from the Constitution, and while political apartheid changed, social apartheid remains. The only difference is that you have black faces in government and black faces on the boards of mining companies. And these were the people who were often foundation-funded, NGO leaders. So this is a way of engineering consent. So you change the image, slight reforms, but the system must remain the same.
So finally, then, what would you say to people who say that the most egregious abuses of these foundations, the creation of the eugenics movement or the suppression of the civil rights movement or things like that, are in the past, and that these days the foundations are by and large working towards things that we can all agree on as good, such as vaccination of third world countries?
Well, you have to generally look a little deeper into the issues. And it's really not that hidden. As you brought up, the stuff is generally open. It's just not looked at. That's the problem. We need more discussion, more examination of the role of foundations. For example, what they're doing today, just take the entire world enclave of NGOs, non-governmental organizations. Now, these are generally viewed with respect. They're promoting social change, attempting to alleviate poverty, discuss human rights, at least challenge in some respects, institutions like the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, IMF, etc. Well, the rise of NGOs was actually foundation engineered, and it was with a very specific purpose. Now, the aim is that it resulted out of the age of what's called structural adjustment, where the World Bank and IMF imposed structural adjustment programs on places like Africa, Latin America, and Asia. This essentially amounted to social genocide, where they wiped out education, healthcare, social services, expanded poverty, created mass inflation, essentially recolonized the entire third world, so-called third world, for the Western imperial powers. This rapid acceleration of poverty created enormous social unrest. So in this context, elites always get very insecure. If there's massive social unrest, you need to address it. You need to create consent to the system. This is the context in which NGOs rose up globally. Now, NGOs today essentially act in the modern imperial project as the missionary groups acted in the old formal colonial period. Now, if you look at missionary societies, the leadership often knew very directly and were very complicit in the fact that this was an imperial project. Missionary groups going to Africa in the 1800s, early 1900s, it was very explicitly imperial. However, the missionaries on the ground often were people with good intentions, just wanting to help educate, civilize the barbarians, what have you. I mean, The aim essentially on their part, on the individual lower level missionaries, was that they had good intentions. But the effect was that while slightly addressing issues of education, alleviating poverty, these types of issues, they were undermining the local indigenous cultures, religions, heritages, language, history, society itself. And thus they made it not only susceptible, but they were able to essentially undermine that whole system and make the colonial political and economic overt colonial oppression sustainable. And the NGOs function in the same way today. While going to places like Africa, they slightly alleviate poverty, slightly address human rights issues, education issues, a whole plethora of other social issues and concepts. Now, the people working on the ground for the NGOs are there with great intentions. I study political science, and the people who study political science who tend to want to change things, you know, don't like the established political or economic order, they tend to go into the NGO world because that's where people with good intentions generally go in this field. And so the people have good intentions, but the leadership and the actual global social role of the foundations is that ultimately they undermine local indigenous movements for liberation because, again, they promote ideology, this sort of Western imperial ideology that we know best and we can help Africans come to terms with what it really means to have good government, our concept of human rights, our concept of democracy, our concept of freedom and liberty and these types of issues. So we promote, again, Western ideology upon African society, slightly alleviating poverty, slightly addressing social issues, filling the void that the state used to fill in these countries, but that the World Bank and IMF forced them to eliminate. So the NGOs come in, slightly alleviate these issues. However, they ultimately undermine indigenous resistance and radical or revolutionary change, because they essentially make people complacent to the system. In that sense, they produce consent, which is the ultimate aim, again, of the foundations. And so they are essentially modern missionaries. And even the anti-globalization movement, as it's referred to, is organized, say, for example, at the World Social Forum, which started in 2001. This is a huge meeting of NGOs, NGO leaders, etc. It's Ford Foundation funded, along with several other foundations. But the Ford Foundation essentially founded the World Social Forum. And it brings together all these NGOs, purportedly under the guise of an anti-globalization movement. But what happens is that with huge infusions of cash and organization from the foundations, NGOs become professionalized. So suddenly people who were once activists out on the street picketing with gas masks in case the police became oppressive, suddenly they're salaried employees attending major international meetings with the World Trade Organization, with the World Bank, hobnobbing with elites. Their salaries increases, they go to the think tanks, they go to the big meetings. Suddenly the system they were once against is now supporting them and has not only professionalized them, but given them status, prestige, and acknowledgement. And for people who are often oppressed by society, who criticize and have been pushed down by the powers that be, this is a very intoxicating change for them. And so the system that they were once against is now supporting them. So for them, the idea of a radical revolutionary or systemic change is no longer on the agenda. It's about reform, mild reforms to the system. And essentially, it's not anti-globalization. It's just reform globalization. It's putting a human face on an inhuman entity. It's about making globalization itself more sustainable and providing consent on a more global scale to this system.
Well, a fascinating subject and one which you've obviously done quite a great deal of research into. So if people are more interested in finding out about this history and the ways that the foundations function in our society, how can they find out more about your work?
Well, you can go to globalresearch.ca. I've written some articles on covering issues that foundations cover, but I'm also writing a current book on global governance, which has foundations as a major subject throughout the entire thing.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to that book, and hopefully we can have you on when that comes out. But Andrew Gavin Marshall, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you very much.